Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Kitchen Curiosity, the podcast where we chip away the stainless steel. We look at the real people, the game-changing ideas, the cutting-edge innovations shaping the food service equipment industry today. I'm your host, Radford Chancellor. And today's episode is a massive one. We're going to be looking at commercial kitchens from two completely different angles. One from the raw, hands-on operational strategy of a culinary legend, and the second from a market-leading refrigeration manufacturer who are part of the Ali Group. It might seem a long time ago now, but you might remember when we first launched Kitchen Curiosity back in season one, which is well over 2 years ago, we had one guest who set the tone for everything that has followed since. He's straight-talking, brilliantly experienced culinary chef, F&B consultant. He also made a brief appearance at Host Milan last year when we were talking about everything around the Host exhibition. He's a chef consultant, a food strategist, a former BBC MasterChef, and the founding father of British modern cuisine in Manchester. He designed the original flavours for Walker's Sensations. He's audited NHS hospitals across 48 hospitals in the UK and spearheaded food and beverage strategies for some of the biggest football stadiums in the UK, including Man City. What I should just say is we're recording this online, so if you hear any slight distortion or noise, a rare treat for me to be recording from home. Anyway, welcome back to Kitchen Curiosity, the man that actually started it all, John Benson Smith. John, welcome back. How are you?
I'm good. I'm looking forward to this.
So, yeah, I mean, what have you been up to? Give us a brief overview about you and what you've been up to, you know, the last couple of years and since we last met.
I get involved with the extreme. You would not believe it. One minute it's about the Olympics and possible design and looking at logistics, and the next phone call can be something completely different. It is so, I'm not going to say amusing, it's so interesting, because food's such a massive subject, actually. It's not just about table three and a set of hot plates and a cold room and an induction unit. You know, it's huge, it's massive.
Okay. So you've been working, you've been doing some stuff on the Olympics, you said, or?
Maybe. you end up signing so many NDAs, I've forgotten who I can talk to now.
One quote that I remembered back from season one was you said that you wanted to be a pop star or professional footballer.
Yeah.
Or motorcycle world champion, but decided to become a chef. What was that all about? And what was it like being a young lad in Yorkshire?
Well, I trialled for Chesterfield and failed. But I did sit next to a guy called Joe Elliott, who was the lead singer of Def Leppard. So that was kind of, you know. And then I was involved with two superbike racing teams.
Right, okay.
But I was shocking at school. Terrible. Wasn't interested at all. But once I got kind of thrown in, you know, 16 years old into an apprenticeship, big tall hats and long white aprons, everybody spoke French. I suddenly managed to unearth the one thing I was pretty good at, which seemed to be food.
But now you've moved on. I mean, obviously, you've been, how long have you been a consultant now?
Probably 15 to 20 years. But the first, I've been in the industry 50 years, and that's a genuine 50 years. But the first 35 were seriously at it, you know, within businesses. And then the consultancy for me just happened accidentally. I wasn't washed up or knackered or kind of fed up. It just happened where people asked me to get involved with this and could you look at this? And then suddenly I worked out that food's a massive subject. And, you know, food development and research and development and all sorts of stuff. And then you know, being involved with heritage and arts and then NHS and then stadia, all sorts of stuff, really. But it's all about eating, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And I mean, I know we touched on this in season one, the first episode. Yeah. We go back to that. But the Walker Sensation crisps, I mean, were involved in designing the flavours there. What does that sort of experience teach you about sort of, you know, real world food? And did you learn anything from that? Or was that just more, you know, I don't know.
Well, there was a couple of chefs that were put forward to Walker's to see how Walker's felt about the individuals. And myself and another very famous chef who had two-star Michelin, and I didn't even have two lucky bags, but you're too young to remember what lucky bags were, Radford. So we were kind of given empty bags of crisps, and we were then told to go to a hotel bedroom where we then presented to a big audience and opened the bag and described to the audience how we felt about the contents. Okay. And the first chef went on, he was lovely and said, "Oh, wonderful thing," and everybody clapped. And I went on and said, "Is this the best you can do? Wow, these things give off a really bad pungent odour. What on earth are they? Surely when you open the bag of crisps, the flavours you should be able to identify from your mouth, if that makes sense." But yeah, it was an amazing time working for them, and I really enjoyed it. And again, it's another indicator that this subject to food can be vast and big, particularly if you're young and you're still wanting to learn. You can go everywhere because all humans have to eat.
Yeah, very true. You'd never be out of a job, I suppose, as a chef. True. So, and you know, you spent some time as a master chef for the BBC. And how does the gap between sort of cooking as an art, if you like, if we talk about Michelin star chefs or whatever, and then actually running a profitable business, you know, has that changed since the last time we spoke? Or
I think the pressure now on commerciality is, you know, extreme. Absolutely extreme. I'm not saying if that's right or wrong, because it's about survival. But I was always commercially minded, and that was forced upon me when I spent 5 years working for Granada Television in Manchester.
Okay.
They were commercial, you know. But, you know, it's part of the package nowadays that you have to understand costings and all the rest of it. You can't just disappear into the heat of the kitchen, can you? Mind you, you can sometimes, you know, use it as an excuse for busy and whatever, but no, it's tough, it's hard.
It is. And why do you think it's hard? Is it the pressures of things like VAT and food costs and energy, or all of the above, kind of?
Yeah, I get often asked, has the industry changed? Yes, 1,000%. End of story. That's it. We were doing ballroom dancing before. Now we're doing Mad Max guerrilla warfare to survive. It's hard, and you've got to have a different set of values and ethos. And as I always say, you're only as good as what you served last night, I suppose, because the customer's not interested in VAT and all the rest of the issues. They're interested in what they're paying for, what it smells and tastes like, and do you smile and make them feel better?
But we're seeing it all the time, aren't we? The pressures. I think UK Hospitality, or was that association, have started a big campaign recently about cutting VAT to 10%. So I mean, let's talk about stadiums, because you spent 20 years or more, and you still are, around designing the strategy, you know, for the biggest stadiums in the world, including Man City. Can you talk us through what feeding in a stadium is really like, and what the pressure's like, what the chaos is like? Yeah.
Well, I accidentally got involved with Manchester City in 2001, or was it in 2002, where one of the directors said to me, "How do you?" Because in those days, without being a big head, or before that, I was probably, in 92 onwards, I was probably seen as Manchester's most successful chef. Because everybody thought, you know, catering in restaurants in a city was stupid. It's never going to happen. So I went to Manchester and we kicked some backsides, and we actually had a really good business. From that wasn't forgotten. And Man City said, "We're looking to build a stadium. How do you fancy getting involved?" And I was still trying to work out, you know, was this a good move or not? And I thought, well, I enjoy pioneering. I enjoy being the first, even if it makes you rather grey and mad. So I just got stuck into Man City, and they were an amazing club that had a vision for great food and hospitality, as well as good football. Okay. And at one stage, I'm sure that the food was probably better than the football. And then from that, it just became a work for Real Madrid and FC Bayern and Crystal Palace and Fulham. I've worked for 15 or 16 different clubs. Recently, Leeds United.
Yeah.
But it's good. It's hard and it's tough. And you can kind of put hotels into a little box regards how they act and behave. You can do the same with theatres and art galleries and heritage. Mm. And actually, the football clubs, without being rude, they all think and act sort of the same. So you kind of know what you're letting yourself in for with that. But to answer your question, it's about logistics. It's about leadership. It's not about democracy, of 17 different opinions, even though you do get that, particularly if you've got contract caterers and clients and whatever. But it's about the Germanic organized approach to things and having a vision and never forgetting that actually the important thing is the ball and the pitch and the referee and VAR. And actually, you're a side issue. So your catering better be good or you're going to get found out and we'll just go somewhere locally.
Yeah, okay. I mean, obviously, it's different, isn't it? Because you've got the concessions, which is kind of one offer.
Yeah.
All the way up to restaurant dining, to VIP suites and more, I suppose.
Yes, yeah. But being involved with the first tough pioneering stuff, the original skirmishes and dragging the clubs and the caterers. And in those days, and I'll argue with anybody, the food generally in 2000 was absolutely shocking everywhere.
Right, okay. In the stadiums?
In the stadiums. They're all as bad as each other. And I understand why. The clients didn't have the vision. And so I got stuck in screaming and pushing and cuddling and mentoring and showing the vision of how we could have these different offers. No different to when you walk into a car park and you've got different styles of things that you enjoy being with and associated with. And that's how it started off.
And then I guess that VIP offer is different as well, isn't it? Does that sort of more the concession bit, I suppose? Is that more the...
That's... Yeah. Okay, right. Well, you know, yes. Typically 12 to 15 different restaurants. You know, you look at Tottenham, you look at what they're doing at Aston Villa, and it's there's so many... And Man City's further vision... That's, you know, what could be classified as the prawn sandwich. Well, actually, more than prawn sandwich. It's tasting menus and it's experiential and all that stuff. Fine, I'm bored with that. The issue is a bit like the NHS, okay, with food. The main issue is the guy that wants to spend £6.
Yeah.
Yes. And he uses the pie to keep his hands warm when it snows, not because he likes the pie. I'm not saying that's the case everywhere. That still needs to be tackled.
Right, okay.
Yes, the queues for the loos, the value for money, the smile, the greeting, variation of menu, that still needs to be... It's all very well having iPads to press and do this and order this online. But when there's 50 people in the bloody queue and I want to get back to see if Doncaster Rovers win or not, that still needs to be tackled. Yeah. But it is a bit better.
And do you think that, you know, over the... What we are, just said like 2000, so 26 years later, they take food and beverage seriously now, whereas before, would it be fair to say it was kind of like an afterthought? Not part, I don't know.
Yeah, there was two or three clubs that took it seriously. Man City were the forerunner, with City Square and the innovation. We had no money, but we used our heart and our vision and our kind of desperation to, you know, make something work. But now it's reasonably common. You know, there are the ones that hung back and didn't want to invest mentally, physically or financially. I think they've now realised that actually that was probably a mistake. And it's going to happen in cricket further and in rugby and all sorts of things. What's wrong with having, you know, decent food that's good value for money and make the whole thing experiential? If your burger's grey and it's cold and it's horrible, I'm sorry, but that does reflect upon the persona of the club.
Yeah,
it
does, definitely. And the guest experience.
Exactly, yeah.
So, just moving on to NHS.
Yes.
We love the NHS. You've done some work, a lot of work with the NHS, and I think 48 hospitals, I believe.
Yes, you're right. I got involved with the first round with Lloyd Grossman, where there were six supposed celebrity chefs, or five, actually, and then there was me, because no one had heard of me. And I spent 2.5 years visiting a lot of hospitals with that. It's tough, it's hard. But the most important thing about all the PR and the marketing and all the celebrities and all that stuff is what Mrs. Jones gets on her plate in Preston. That's where it starts and finishes. So to me, the PR and marketing and all that's rubbish. Forget it. Let's just go back to what's hot's hot, what's cold's cold, what tastes good, what's value, and start holding the management and the leaders totally and utterly accountable for why the fact that the cold potatoes was cooked 3 weeks last Tuesday. I'm not saying it's the same everywhere. It's not. You know, democracy does not work in a lot of cases in food.
Yeah.
Because the best, most successful businesses are not democratic, but the NHS thing, again, unfortunately, for all the hard work and lovely people, it hasn't worked.
Yeah.
And I know that because I spent half my life in the hospital. Yeah.
But it's so important, isn't it, for the patients and people there, you know?
Yeah, and it does. It's tough, but it's that's not about management. It's about leadership. And unfortunately, you do make yourself unpopular.
So we're almost coming to the end of this section. We've got a little bit more time. But, thinking about since we last sat down, not Host Milan, but like season one, what do you think the industry's got better at, got worse at, or got different?
I think it's got better at trying to be united. I don't mean football, but it's had to get united because of
more
the
collaboration,
pressures, I think. Well, yes, but still you've got societies and associations that are still fragmented. You know, whereas in other countries, for example, in France, they have a society called Eurotox, T-O-Q-U-E-S, and that is a very semi-political association where the chefs and the caterers get together as one, and they demonstrate, and they're really, really, this isn't just, you know, a bit of PR. It's just, so I think that's probably better. The tough stuff has been, I think, the change in, I wouldn't say, am I going to say change in government? Yes, I'm going to. So it's the change in government, and it's tough times. It's a recession, but no one dare say it. So actually, it's hard for everybody. And you could argue that there were far too many catering establishments in the first place. I don't know. But it's hard, and it's a tough life. And for right or for wrong, it will begin to affect further the collaborative other businesses in the same sector that supply and make materials. Yeah, it's hard.
Absolutely. You know? I think you're right. I mean, the high street changed, doesn't it? Because, you know, obviously with the rise of Amazon online shopping, all of that.
Yeah.
And is it fair to say that food service had in some part stepped in some of that gap? And maybe there is in some areas a little bit of saturation. I don't know. But it is difficult times.
Yeah. But going back to the point you made just now about, you know, things changed, I think I'll be popular with this one. I think there's a lot of ageism, unfortunately, in catering within the UK. A lot, so many amazing guys and girls, 50 plus, that just get frozen out, that aren't really wanted, which is foolish when you've got so much wisdom, experience and real knowledge in the industry that can help, you know, with things, which is so disappointing. But saying that, you know, if people are clever and smart, the food industry can take you anywhere, literally, and you can do anything.
Yeah.
You know, and even though I'm old and frail now, Radford, and I've lost my drive, which is a load of rubbish, you know, I'm probably an example of someone who's still at it 100%.
Yeah, definitely. And just talking about that, you're launching a YouTube channel this year, I believe.
Yes. Yeah, it's going to be called Fresh Food Roots. And this is filmed in its entirety in my home kitchen. It's unscripted, no fuss, on an iPhone or two iPhones. It's not staged perfection. It's all about having a laugh and, you know, supermarket produce, easy to follow, simple recipes that's aimed at the public. So chefs are not allowed to watch this, okay? It's not chefy at all. It's about simple cooking. Thank you. And it's about systems, processes, procedures, to a certain extent, of how to organise a dinner party. This has been done, that's been done, put that together, bang, 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 and I can enjoy the dinner, not have your kitchen looking like a total and utter bloody mess, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
It's about trying to give back with some knowledge. Okay. And the response to that's been amazing. I was quite shocked, actually.
Well, I think it's...
I didn't think people liked me, Radford.
I think they like your straight talking and no-nonsense approach.
Well...
So...
But I'm not a... When you use the word consultant, I don't wear a suit. I don't have a briefcase. I don't sell cookers and talk about osmosis, whatever that... I thought osmosis was a disease, but it's not. I've kind of come up through the industry, but I can you know, talk about logistics and ergonomics. You can show me a design and I want to know about the journey of the chicken from when it enters the back door dead to where it goes on the plate and where the drawer of the left is and this and that. And it's all about systems, process, procedures, but it's all about the logistics and ergonomics. That's so important nowadays. Can I just throw something else in?
Absolutely. Bradford?
So, this gentleman here.
For the benefit of the listeners, he's showing me a book.
Nico Ladenis, he had 2-star Michelin. And I went to work for him many years ago for a short period of time in Chez Nico. And halfway through service, the kitchen extraction broke. And he yelled at me to come outside with him. And he took out a broom. And he was there poking the extraction unit outside. And he turned around to me when we got back in the kitchen and said to me, if only everything was as good as those. And you know what he was pointing to, Radford? His Williams fridges.
There you are.
True story. Send me the money. But there's a true story of that. And that's what got me seriously looking at Williams, because it came from a guy that knew his yeah. stuff.
John, I'm going to ask you to sit quietly just in your home studio, and I'm going to sit down with Kai Sandham for Williams Refrigeration, and then we're going to invite you back in about 10 minutes. Thank you. Williams Refrigeration have been the cornerstone of food service manufacturing since 1980. Built and headquartered here in the UK in King's Lynn, they're the world-leading manufacturer and supplier of professional commercial refrigeration. And they're actually today's episode sponsor. Joining me now is Kai Sandham. He's the National Account Manager for Williams. Kai, welcome to Kitchen Costi. How are you?
Hi, Radford. I'm good, thanks.
Your first time with us, I think.
Yeah, it definitely is, yeah. I'm camera shy, or audio shy, should we say.
So, yeah, but before we get into, you know, Williams and engineering and all of that kind of stuff, mm-hmm. how did you, I mean, I know, but for the listeners, how did you get into food service equipment? A little bit about your journey, you know, your kind of upbringing, if you like, and then into yeah. food service equipment.
Well, actually, I always wanted to be an architect, but unfortunately, I wasn't quite bright enough. I couldn't do physics very well, so and all the studying kind of put me off a bit. But once I graduated in another degree, I basically moved to London and worked in restaurants as various guises, bar, service, etc., etc., working out some management. And my father actually was already in the catering industry, and he had his own small mm-hmm. business. And so I went and worked for him for a couple of years, and then basically learned the ropes and moved on to Bratt Brothers, I was there for 13 years. Basically, I've been at all sides. So it's, you know, project management, design, sales, all sides of the industry. And basically, when I went to Williams, it was after 3 years as a consultant, so design consultancy with SHW, my friend Gareth. And then basically, the job at Williams came up, and I was just interested. It's basically the side of the business, the industry, that I'd never worked in. So it was a change.
Yeah, you've covered all the bases, really. Obviously, Gratt Brothers, highly respected food service supplier, kitchen house, whatever. And then SHW, again, another highly respected food service design consultant. And now Williams, so quite a pedigree, really.
A highly respected manufacturer.
Yeah, exactly. So quite a pedigree of premium companies, really. So Williams, you know, they've got a good reputation for sustainability in their products. Can you just talk around a little bit about some of your products, such as Green Logic and, you know, things like that, really?
Yeah, well, the Green Logic's basically Williams' commitment to green refrigeration, and it's been around since we began, since the 1980s. Okay. We were first to introduce CFC-free insulation in the 80s. In the 90s, first catering to use environmentally friendly refrigerants. And we've also brought in, you know, hydrocarbon refrigerants, et cetera, smart controllers, which are energy saving. So it's basically, it's everything is a drive with the business as a whole. So it's basically product, manufacturing, transport, all those elements that come to basically give us a greener solution at the end of the day.
Okay, so it's not just a product, it's the whole package, the whole business ethos, really.
Yeah, yeah. If I'll give you some sort of ideas, I mean, some of our green credentials, for example, 35% of our energy for the factories are generated by solar panels.
Okay.
100% of cabinets are natural refrigerant. 99% of the products are recyclable, mm-hmm. as in 99% of the materials are recyclable. So yep. It's all these things that are, you know, a part of the sustainability criteria. So all of these things, innovation, refrigerant selection, value for money, serviceability, food safety and hygiene, all of these basically ending with a minimal environmental impact.
Why do you think why is it so important for Williams? I mean, obviously you're the market leader, but why is it important to be environmentally friendly for Williams, do you think?
I think we want to do our part for the planet, to be honest. You know, there is going to be legislation as well that's coming in. So it was kind of, rather than keeping up with the legislation, we're kind of, we foresee it and we are sort of ahead of the game. So usually we're ahead of the game. So
so recently you've launched a new product to the, well, the UK and Europe, and I saw it in Milan, actually, yeah. The multi-temp cabinets and counters. We've always kind of had the multi-temp drawers, but now mm-hmm. we've got cabinets that are multi-temp, so that's like fridge or freezer and both, if you like, the same unit. It's an industry first. Mm-hmm. Can you explain a bit about that, the thought behind that, and why it's important, I suppose?
Well, it's an industry first, as you say. We're basically building on the success of the Varitemp drawers, for example. Now, obviously, they're really good in passes, and basically so you can, you know, change products and gives you basically flexibility. So we thought, well, you know, these are really successful. Why don't we look to do it into cabinets as well?
Okay.
So what we've done, it's not just a switch from fridge to freezer. It is the whole temperature range. So basically they go from +8 to -22. Okay, so it caters for every kind of bit of produce, for example, like meat, -2 to +2, cheese, +5 to +8, whatever it may be, ice cream, -12. So you can go from anything between +8 to -22 and anything in between.
Okay, so if you're looking for a special fridge for chocolate, or I don't know, or something like that.
Ice cream, you know, gelato, you know, fish, meat, cheese. Basically, there is a temperature, a precise temperature that you can operate very easily from just a switch. So it's literally, you can go up to the unit, say it's at +8, for example, mm-hmm. and I want to put it down to, let's say, -16, perhaps for, let's just say, ice cream, for example.
Mm-hmm.
I will literally just press the temperature button and the up and down button accordingly. It will get down to that temperature, and basically it will reach that temperature within about 20 minutes.
Pretty quick.
Yeah. And vice versa. I mean, definitely within 25 minutes going either way. So either from fridge to freezer or vice versa.
And how's that kind of been received in the market, do you feel, you know?
It's been received very, very well. I mean, there's a lot of interest in those units. Basically, you know, it's because it gives you a huge amount of flexibility. If there's, you know, seasonal variations, so in the produce, you've been having a lot of frozen food, say, perhaps during the summer. But then in the winter, you've been getting a lot more fresh food. We're just using these examples. Then you've got the flexibility within that unit.
To chop and change.
To chop and change. So menu changes, staff changes, operational changes. So, mm-hmm. for example, in CPUs, for example, it's a great bit of kit to have in a CPU, because these CPUs often get rented out to different operators. They'll be using different produce, different ratios of fresh to frozen, etc. And so it goes on.
And from a perspective point of view, a design, how does the multi-temp change the conversation between you as a manufacturer and a consultant or a kitchen distributor? you know, does it change the conversation? Or
I suppose it changes the conversation because there's not so much pressure on having a fixed storage facility, if you like, if you know what I'm saying. So you're not sort of rigidly stuck into, well, we're going to be having 2/3 frozen food, 1/3, you know. Mm. It basically gives you far more flexibility and you don't have to be overly concerned about that in the initial design process.
Okay.
It can change and vary depending on the operator or the menu or the produce.
Yeah. I mean, it's fantastic, really, because I know, even from experience, you know, you might put in 2 or 3 cabinets, fridges, mm-hmm. 2 freezers, and then suddenly the operator is like, well, no, I want 4 freezers, 1 fridge, or vice versa. Exactly. And that might be a personal chef thing, not necessarily, you know, it doesn't mean the design's wrong, it's just that's what they want.
Yeah, so it's quite a future-proofing as well. Mm. So the longevity of these cabinets, you know, if the operator changes, the premises are taken over by somebody else, then they've got basically, not a blank canvas, but you know what I'm saying, they've got options.
For this segment, we keep it quite short, but just kind of coming up, the final question, Williams, you've been supporting chefs and commercial kitchens 45 years. What is the one thing that hasn't really changed about refrigeration? Doesn't matter how much technology moves on. Is there something that hasn't really changed? Or,
well, the reliability from William's okay. side. From William's right. side, I mean, basically, the chef just wants a reliable piece of kit. He wants it not to be breaking down, not to, you know. So as far as that goes, no, it hasn't really changed.
Okay. So that's kind of what chefs want. Overarching is that is reliability, that product that will keep working.
I would say so. Reliability and robustness.
Okay. Is there anything new coming up that you can share with us, or you're not allowed to because of competitors, or, you know, I don't know, anything, little bits of information you give us? Or?
Well, I mean, we're, you know, again, working on our sort of green logic, we've now introduced, obviously, the carbon calculators. So all of our products are now, the majority of our products have got their embodied carbon figures associated mm-hmm. with them, which obviously is becoming a big deal in the industry at the moment. So it's basically reducing your carbon footprint. Unfortunately, you know, the kitchen, as we know, if we're in a BNI situation or something like that, the kitchen is always the place that kind of gets left to the last moment. Mm-hmm. So we're going to be getting a smaller and smaller allowance for carbon, embodied carbon, if you see what I'm saying, to keep within the realms of the total carbon within a building, so we say.
Yes, yeah, because the kitchen is always the last bit.
Exactly that. So, yeah, so we've made advancement in that. Basically, consultants can actually go on to our website now and they can basically build their own cold room, get a budget cost, and also get the embodied carbon figure for that room.
Okay.
That's definitely an industry first. Anyone else is doing that at the moment.
Yeah.
We're trying to basically give all the tools to the operators and to the consultants so they've got everything at their fingertips, just simply by, you know, going on the website, doing a small calculation, and that will all be fed back to the back to them. So, yeah.
Okay.
We're moving forward still.
After 45 years. Okay, well, we're going to just cut to a short break and then I'm going to invite you back with John and we're going to have a bit of a group chat and also some fun questions to keep you on your toes. So, thanks for that, Kai.
Thanks.
Welcome to the world of Ali, the largest and most diverse food service equipment company on the planet. With over 110 brands under the Ali Group umbrella, we serve more than 150 countries worldwide. Our brands are at the forefront of innovation, offering cutting-edge technology and ergonomic designs that keep pace with the ever-evolving market. But we're not just a global leader, we're a network of local companies working together to deliver excellence. To learn more, visit alligroup.com.
All right, well, let's bring both of my guests back and we're going to have a bit of a group discussion about the market, Williams, and a few fun questions as well. Just to remind you that we are recording this remotely, so if you get any slight delay or whatever, we're all having the enjoyment of being at home today to record, which is quite nice. Welcome back, John and Kai. Thank you for hanging on for the break. We were talking there a bit about multi-temp, you know, the Jade multi-temp products and Williams' focus on sustainability. John, I know you've got quite a strong view on this about sustainability. You know, and what's the difference between sort of fix, sort and mend, if you like, in that arena of sustainability?
I just see, for all the wonderful things that happen in our industry, and industry I mean as in manufacturing and distributors and food makers, I see an awful lot of equipment thrown away. Or the bigger sin is the stuff that's purposefully designed to fall to bits after 3 years. And we've, in some ways, we've got to rethink that. Whilst it's good for sales and turnover, actually, if we're talking sustainability, that bit pretty well scares me. But I want to have a license just to ask Kaj and yourself, Radford, to me. Imagine if. So I've seen catering kitchen equipment over a genuine 50 years, and in some ways, not a lot's changed. We still have the cold room that's the box with the seal and the thing, evaporator that all bends, and then the pipes. I'm not saying with Williams, but imagine if we had a cold room or a freezer room without walls and without doors, and it was operated via air curtains.
Wow. Okay.
Now, that's what I want to see. And I think the industry wants to see. Often manufacturers who are amazing at what they do, they don't get close enough to the end operators. So I could see this kind of round table thing of Kaj and his guy from Williams sat there in King's Lynn. Sounds a long way away, Radford, doesn't it? And a group from all sectors getting involved with what does refrigeration and freezer and food temp and care look like in 5-10 years time. Now, the cold room and the freezer without walls and without doors operated via air curtains and air doors, you probably think, is this guy mad? Well, I was with two mad people a few years ago. One's called Nigel Harris from Absolute Taste in Bicester, and the other mad person was a guy called Nick Worth from Worth Research. He has a company regards robotics, let's not laugh.
Yeah.
And he was also involved for many years regards aerodynamics of F1. So if you think about typically, we're not heating kitchens, we've got the heat from the cooking and the food. And we then have another source of cold or hot from regards keeping stuff hot and then storage. And we then pay to remove that, don't we? And we then bring coal back in. And they also then have a separate load of heat issues with regards keeping customers. It was just an idea. It's that, those kind of conversation, I think, that's really important for the next 5-10 years onwards. Sorry.
Yeah, no. I think you're right. I mean, air curtains for, what do you think, Kai? Air curtains for keep the no walls? Maybe Tim would freak out at that.
it's an interesting one, but probably Tim would freak out at that. But I think Michael, I mean, I don't know if you know Michael Leavis, who's our refrigeration engineer or refrigeration manager, he would absolutely love to have a go at something like that, I'm sure.
We'll talk.
Is it beyond the realms of capability? I mean, can't see. Everything's possible, I would have thought.
Well, I saw a version of this.
Really?
And I was shocked. So,
okay.
To everybody, contact Nick Worth. Say hello to him in Worth Research. This guy is a proper rocket scientist. I was shocked. That's the future we need to be striving for.
Yeah. I think that there is, you know, there is obviously innovation going on that maybe sometimes also that we don't know about because manufacturers won't discuss. Yeah. I mean, if we look at, it's slightly off-piste, but Silco at Milan Host launched a new cooking block suite, which they actually developed with a couple of leading Michelin star chefs, leading engineer, and a designer that actually designs for Ferrari.
Wow.
And it's an impressive bit of kit. If you go on and have a look at it, Silco's new cooking block, because they've totally redesigned it. And it's exactly what you said, that a lot of kitchen equipment is just modular, doesn't look particularly sexy, or, you know, they've...
Same old stainless steel box.
Yeah, exactly. And they kind of reinvented that slightly. It's good. But we divest. It's still an Ally Group company. No, so, but anyway. So, you know, Kai, from your perspective, you've been a consultant and then obviously, you know, working with Grat Brothers and now as with Williams, and you're looking after consultants. When people are designing kitchens for stadiums, hotels, restaurants, and a consultant of John's caliber comes through the door, what does that conversation look like from your perspective now as a manufacturer?
Well, I mean, we have to fully understand John's brief, really.
Yeah.
You know, we sort of like, we're always obviously innovating. So all of our units, et cetera, we're working in high ambient temperatures. And so, you know, really, we'd be discussing the flows, his requirements, you know, and basically, well, we'd let John lead, I think. But I think, you know, basically, we've got pretty much, we feel, most pieces of kit for most scenarios. So hopefully it's a case of just marrying John's ideas with our own products, and hopefully it would work fairly well. Mm. Obviously with the sustainability as well.
John, you know, you've worked in stadiums and kitchens, and, you know, staffing is a constant nightmare, let's be honest. Mm. Having flexible equipment, you know, be it like the Williams multi-temp counters or cabinets, or things like, you know, Ivario pans, or, you know, is this important to have sort of flexible equipment now?
Yes, I think it is. And I think we talk about mental health with chefs, and it's so dependent on the environment that you're working. If I've got lots of light and fresh air, and I've got decent equipment where logistics and ergonomics have been thought through, and there's a process and a system, I'm happy. But if not, we have some hell holes, unfortunately, all the time. But I think decent kit is really important. But the number one thing manufacturers need to appreciate is we need to train the staff somehow. There's so many bits of kit I see where the chef ain't got a clue. Or, if I press this, do I get Facebook on it? You know, joking apart. And 67% of chefs are dyslexic. All right? Think on that one. And manufacturers need to take on board some of the equipment. I just say, for God's sake, how do I turn this damn thing on or off? You know, it's often too complicated. Or it's like EVs. It's so damn complicated. You want to go back to the basics in some ways.
Yeah. That's a fair comment, especially the Chinese EVs. So let's talk about sustainability. We touched on it before. Yeah. You know, John, Kai, you know, you both come in on it. Is it a tick box exercise? Or is, you know, what is it, you know?
I would say that it depends upon who you're supplying to and who you are a supplier of. Because I can't cope with values and ethos that are written on the MD's wall or the corridor that are absolute rubbish. You'll get found out. So I think, you know, we either care or we don't. If you don't care, put a sign up saying, we don't care. I don't know. I see some horrible stuff. But there are people that do. You know, I would say to a distributor, are you going to walk away from getting that sale because that company don't care?
Fair. Guy, what's your view? Is it a tick box exercise, or is it more than that, sustainability?
Well, again, I think it's a personal thing. So, you know, some people do care, some people don't. I think hopefully in most cases it's more than a box-ticking exercise. I mean, there's so much global warming, et cetera. You know, definitely things are changing. And so we do need to kind of start looking after the planet a bit better. So I'll say yes, it probably is the majority more than a box-ticking exercise.
Yeah. Okay. And, you know, people often say like, sustainable equipment is too expensive. Is that true? Or is that just a myth?
Or has it been too cheap beforehand?
True. Yeah, exactly.
Well, I don't think it is too expensive. I mean, you've got to look at it, you know, for basically its longevity. So, you know, if you buy a piece of kit, I mean, Williams kit, you know, really, I mean, John was mentioning earlier about kit that's built to last for 3 years and then sort of fall apart. We know there's plenty of that sort of stuff about. Williams has never been like that. And as you see, I mean, there's Williams units 30 odd years old, still out in the field, you know, still chugging away, probably not as environmentally friendly as they should be, but they're doing their job. So it's, you know, and also let's not forget, you're going to be saving money,
yeah,
running costs in the long run. So within you know, a year, you've probably made your money back anyway.
Exactly. Okay. So just before we finish this section, John, you only had the choice of one piece of kitchen equipment in a kitchen. What would it be and why?
It would be my best non-stick Circulon pan that they've just given me because they've agreed to be a sponsor for Fresh Food Roots.
Love it. You'll have nothing to cook it on, but you'll have a lovely pan.
Yeah.
And Kai, the same question for you, but you're not allowed to say Williams fridge.
Oh, okay. Well, I'd like to say a combination of them then.
Okay. Yeah. Well, dishwasher here in my house. It's always on.
All yours, yeah.
Got two legs.
Yeah. No, I actually want a robot. That would be great to be cleaning the floor. We've got three cats, so constantly hoovering the bloody floors. Okay, we're going to go on to a bit of a quick fire round. So try, you know, short, punchy answers if we can, and I might throw a few others in. John, in one sentence, what's the biggest mistake operators still make when designing a new F&B concept?
There's no detailed design brief, or they don't understand what one is. So if I was a manufacturer or a distributor, I would send them an example of a design brief talking about hand movements, menu price, complexity, size of kitchen, staffing level, and take the horse to water. Design briefs are not optional. There's so many horrible kitchens that just have just, it's a CAD drawing with a load of metal boxes in it, and there's no thought process. But we get the PO raised and we're all happy and we're at a sale.
Yeah, no, I agree. No concept or feasibility behind it. So, Kai, in a sentence, you know, one piece of advice you give to a chef to make their refrigeration last twice as long. I mean, obviously, buy Williams, but...
Yeah, firstly, buy Williams. No, but mainly, I mean, just probably a PPM, preventive maintenance. So just keep the unit serviced, keep it cleaned regularly, and you shouldn't have any problems.
Cool. So both of you, I'm going to ask this question to put you on the spot a bit. Best meal you've ever eaten anywhere in the world, John?
In Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, I trained probably between 600 and 800 chefs who were typically Indian. And I think the best meal I ever ate was in one of the restaurants I worked in and designed called Solia. We had a number of them. And I literally burst into tears over dinner because the food that these guys cooked was just outstanding. Wow. And obviously they were my dishes.
Yeah. What sort of dishes were you talking about?
Some of the Middle Eastern stuff, but also some quite simple stuff. But particularly with the fish, their ability to be able to cook the fresh fish to a cuisson was fantastic. And I didn't have to tell them 17 times. You showed them twice. And these guys would replicate really amazing dishes. Fantastic.
Kai, for you, best dish you've ever eaten in the world?
Probably, I went to a beautiful little Nepalese restaurant in Malaga last year. And I couldn't tell you the name of it, to be honest with you. But the food was just out of this world. I'm not, you know, it was exciting. It was innovative. You know, it was, but obviously, most importantly, tasted absolutely out of this world. So, yes, I would like to go back there.
And John, how would you describe the state of the UK hospitality industry at the moment?
I think it's very scary and very challenging. And certainly, if I can ever help anybody over a computer screen, a chocolate biscuit and a cup of coffee to try and help somebody, I'd do so. But let's not forget, there's someone called the customer. Mm. And smiling and being nice to them, even though you've got some really horrible things to deal with, is so important.
Cool. Okay. And Kai, you know, if there's one kitchen that you'd love to spec out or design, going back to your SHW days maybe, where would it be?
I would have liked to have done the Mandarin Oriental, actually.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I would have liked to have done that.
It's actually closing this year, isn't it, I think? I think it's actually closing its door this year, I believe. The Heston one is.
The Heston one is later this year, yeah.
But why there? Just because of the food and the...
The food, the ambiance, and I suppose the clearness.
And again, for you, Kai, one word that you describe Williams Refrigeration in 2026. Just Kai.
Innovative.
Okay. So finally, for both of you, if you could go back and give your younger self one piece of advice, you know, when you first started your careers, what would it be?
Don't do it. I'll just tell myself, you know, basically be open-minded. Mm. Never expect anything normal, you know. Always look out for the unexpected. Let's just say that.
Don't try and put chef's jacket and trousers on top of your jeans and jumper. True story. No one told me.
Well, that brings us to the end of the podcast. Thank you both so much. I hope you both kind of enjoyed it. And John, we look forward to your YouTube channel coming out. No pressure. Thank you. Well, that's the end of this episode. Well, a brilliant episode. And huge thanks to John Benson-Smith for coming back onto Kitchen Curiosity for a full, proper episode. We've missed you since your last appearance on season one, episode one. And if you want to listen to that, you can go back for our back catalogue and get hold of it. You can also check out Milan Host episode, which was last November. And thanks again to Kai Sandham from Williams Refrigeration for being such a fantastic host and sponsor of this episode today. If you want to find out more about John's F&B consultancy work, please head over to his website at johnbensonsmith.com. And likewise, if you want to hear about Williams Refrigeration and the groundbreaking multi-temp range and the Green Logic sustainability initiatives, visit williams-refrigeration.co.uk. If you get time, please subscribe to Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon, and leave us a review as well if you've enjoyed the show. Or you can visit our website, kitchencuriosity.co.uk. Until next time, keep your kitchens efficient, your operations sharp, your curiosity live. I've been your host, Radford Chancellor, and you've been listening to Kitchen Curiosity.
Kitchen Curiosity is written and hosted by Radford Chancellor and is edited and produced by Tom Anderson. Kitchen Curiosity is a Sound Rebel production.